Can you believe it? We are still in the book of Genesis. Let's go to Genesis chapter 39. You know, after I came to the church here, I think about 3 or 4 months in, we started Genesis 1. We went Genesis 1 through 11 and we took a break, and then we started Genesis 12 on Sunday nights in our Sunday night Bible study, and we've been going through it. And we're like 2 years of study into the book of Genesis, and I'm feeling like, are we ever going to get this book done? Here we go, Genesis 39. We've been going and going and going on this, and I think when Jesus returns, we might still be soaking in the book of Genesis. I'm not sure, but we are continuing our study tonight, and it's been ever so slow but fruitful, and I've really enjoyed these characters. And we're in a section of Scripture, particularly in Genesis 39, that has always been a lifelong favorite section for me. The account of Joseph in Egypt has been something that I've always enjoyed from vacation Bible school age all the way up to this week when I was studying it. I truly love this passage, and it's always been instructive for me as a man. And I've just had a particular affection for this passage. If you recall, we're dealing with Joseph is where we're at. The rest of this book of Genesis primarily deals with the central character of Joseph. As I said, he gets the most airtime of any of the brothers, though the entire series we're doing is called The Brothers, dealing with the 12 sons of Jacob. Joseph is the one that kind of comes front and center here. If you remember from a couple of weeks ago, we looked how Joseph was the 11th born from Jacob. He was the first son, though, of Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel. And because of this position of being the firstborn son of the favorite wife, Joseph became the firstborn, not the firstborn, but rather the first in favoritism and in love. He went from being the 11th born to kind of the priority position through a just sheer act of favoritism. And we looked through it, and we got to the point where Joseph was betrayed by his brothers. They thought about killing him, decided, nah, let's not kill him, let's sell him into slavery. And they sold him into slavery, and those that took Joseph off into slavery started heading toward Egypt. Then last week, we looked at this passage that was pretty tough. Meanwhile, back in the Promised Land, back in Canaan, we looked at the passage of Judah and Tamar. And I didn't write it, okay, but it was pretty bad, right? So I'm just delivering the mail. I didn't write the mail here. It was a pretty rough passage, but it dealt with this debacle. If you remember how Judah and Tamar have this thing where Tamar dresses as a prostitute and Judah solicits Tamar as a prostitute, and everything gets really muddled, and there's a lot of sin involved. And then eventually it comes out that throughout all that sin, God uses it in his grace to eventually give rise to Perez, who is part of the lineage of Jesus Christ. So it is Judah who's the key figure in a redemptive sense. But as far as in the narrative here, it is this youngest of his sons, the second youngest, I should say, Joseph, who takes the reins here. We look in this and we start seeing Joseph kind of at the bottom of his experience. Joseph is sold into slavery and arriving in Egypt, in a foreign land where he's never been, doesn't speak the language, doesn't have any connections whatsoever. And it's hard for me to imagine a lower point than that. And the theme that you're going to hear over and over as we read this passage is that the Lord was with Joseph. You're going to hear it over and over and over. And it's going to be the lesson that with the Lord, when he is with you, he can help you to overcome, and when he is with you, there's a promise there that he will walk with you in the midst of your heartache. Now, a lot of times people will hear that kind of promise and will think, well, if I believe in Jesus, then the Christian life is just walking down the ice cream aisle and picking out what I want. That's not the Christian life. The Christian life is walking through a lot of difficulties and trials and troubles, and I don't think anyone in here has been through anything like what we're about to describe Joseph went through. And so that we can take heart knowing that God was with Joseph and God is with us. So we do begin the story, and it starts out that Joseph was taken down to Egypt. And so it's a change of scene, we're told right away in verse 1 of Genesis 39. He's left behind this in the narrative. We've left behind Tamar and Judah and everything that's happened back in Canaan land. We're going to intersect that again. It's going to come back. But Joseph has been sold off and he's gone down. Now the Egypt that he comes to, it's worth taking a minute and a half here in describing this. It was a land of a lot of small villages inhabited by a lot of peasants that would work the land and raise vegetables and raise grain to feed their family. It was a strictly agricultural society. And it was one of the strongest societies of the ancient world, as you well know, the Egyptian society. When the annual flooding of the Nile would deposit very rich minerals around, and there could be a lot of crops and cattle that would grow up, and it was very good for domesticating. Most of the land was just that. It was farmland. And it was a rich nation because it was agricultural. But it did have a few very large cities. It had Hierapolis, who was the center of Ra worship, the sun god Ra. It had Memphis, the city, was devoted to worship of Apis, the sacred bull. But most of the population was out in the rural towns. One thing that was marked in Egypt was the amount of superstition. And there were some 2,000 gods that they worshipped in their belief system, including the Pharaoh himself. He was just one of the gods, a living god on earth. And it was a belief system that was obsessed with life after death. You know, the Egyptians, specifically, they were great builders. They would build using a lot of slave labor or citizens that had skills. And so a lot of the population was this indentured servant in slavery. It was much similar to how we would view employment today. You would be indentured to someone and you would serve them. So master and slave relationship were very important in the Egyptian society. And most people's huts would be made out of mud bricks. But of course, the Egyptians are known for their buildings out of stone. And I really enjoy documentaries about pyramids and things like that. I really like the Sphinx and the pyramids and listening to many things of that nature. And I was listening to one the other night, and I just jotted this down, that all the pyramids of Giza were built, and they had stones that some of them individually weighed 15 tons, and they were all precisely placed. And all of the pyramids were built over a period of 100 years, which doesn't sound like a huge accomplishment, 100 years to build four great pyramids, but that means the number of bricks that have been estimated, that they would have had to have laid one brick every 3 minutes, day and night, for 100 years to lay that many bricks. So you can imagine that building and adding to their structures was very, 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 very important to them. A very complicated and layered society with large cities and agricultural lands and civil projects going on, much of like what we have here today. There are big projects that are done on large scales, and there's a lot of bureaucracy. I read some in preparation for this about the different officials at all the different levels. There would be thousands of scribes, like there are today, recording events and doing things like that. They had a lot of military accomplishments, a lot of scientific accomplishments. The first to work out that the calendar was 365 and a quarter days. And of this giant society, there's a dude named Joseph that comes rolling in on a slave market into this huge, complex society, one of the great civilizations of the world. He comes rolling in. So you can imagine kind of, there's the big fish in the small pond. He is the littlest fish in the biggest pond you could possibly imagine. And it's amazing to see the upward mobility that he has, because, kind of a spoiler alert, he is elevated all the way up to the highest point of this society in a few weeks. And he starts at the beginning of 39 at the absolute, I can imagine a lower point than coming in as a piece of property as a slave from Canaan land into a foreign nation. So we're going to see over the course of the next few weeks how God used him and God was with him, and Lord willing, we'll be instructed by it. So I'm going to read this in three chunks. It's the three chunks that are on your outline as we continue to study our study in the brothers. And I've called this lesson tonight, Joseph's Success. And the reason I'm calling it that, and there's a lot of bad stuff that happens to Joseph in this. I mean, it's bad. Nothing really goes right for Joseph here. It's just bad and then kind of bad and then bad. So it's just like that's what happens to Joseph here. But when you look at it, he's not just another guy that's down on his luck, because the Lord is with him through it all. So we're going to look at this, and we're going to go through these three sections together. The first, in section 1 through 6, is Joseph. Why did I put an apostrophe S there? Joseph's and his blessing. What am I doing? Okay. Joseph's and his blessing. That's a apostrophe catastrophe right there. Imagine that's not there. Joseph and his blessing. I think I was going to put Joseph's blessing, and then I had to put the and his. Anyway, an editing mistake there. So Joseph's blessing here is the first thing. When he was at home at Hebron, if you recall, he was the troublemaker, and he's been the tattletale, and he was thrown into the slave market by his brothers. And this is where we join the story in Genesis 39, 1 through 6. Let me read this text and have a few comments. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, he's an important guy in the story, Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him, from the Ishmaelites, who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, there's the key, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house and all that he had put under his authority. So it was that from the time that he made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had, except for the bread which he ate. So the Lord has taken him at this point, and he is making God, and you heard it over and over, made him successful, prospered him, made him a blessing. And Joseph is, in a lot of ways, a wonderful example. He's an exemplar. It's someone that we can hold up to man and woman alike and say, this is the kind of guy you need to be. When you get put into situations in difficult circumstances, the blessing of the Lord on you needs to be evident to those around you, unbelievers around you specifically, that you are trusting in the Lord. It needs to be obvious to them. And the blessing of the Lord was very evident to the people that were in Potiphar's household. And the ranking there that's in the first couple of verses is very important. That Potiphar was an official of the office. He was an officer of Pharaoh. He was a captain of the guard, an Egyptian. So he was a high-ranking military officer, or in some way connected to the military just under Pharaoh. So it was just the luck of the draw that he was not hired as a farmhand, because most people were farmhands in that society. He happened to be hired and bought out of slavery by this man Potiphar, who put him in his household. And instantly the Lord was prospering Joseph. We can imagine exactly through his hard work of his own being and his own doing. And he was doing pretty well. He was working hard. He was honest. He was faithful. He was well-liked, apparently. The people that he lived with got the message, and the house that he was in was blessed by him. And if he had stayed back home in Hebron, in Canaan land, he would have been just pampered by daddy, and he probably wouldn't have developed the kind of character that comes from just getting hard work and obeying orders of people above you. And that's what God does, is he builds our character by putting us in jobs and giving us people to obey and tests us as servants. And people are watching us where we go. And those of us that are still in the workforce that go out and look are very aware of this, that we're under authority and we need to be a blessing to our employers. That's another lesson from Joseph. And I actually read one commentary that said we should be able to pray, Lord, will you bless my boss so that my boss will know who you are and that I serve you? Will you give him this kind of blessing on my boss? Not for our own sake, but will you bless those around me and get glory from that? And you, to put it in kind of a finer way, is that I work in a shop where there's hiring and, you know, firing quite a bit, and I understand all that goes on in that. And it needs to be in that process. Wouldn't it be great if HR managers just had a general saying? They would say, man, those evangelical Christians, I wish I had a million of them working for me. They are the hardest working, nicest people that were honest to the core, and they're just as faithful as they can be and would never do you wrong. I wish that were the reputation that people that claim Jesus Christ have. And for the most part, there is, you know, by and large. But a lot of people claim to be Christians and fall short of that, sadly, to the point where they can deny their faith, deny their profession in the way that they work out in their jobs. So if we profess that we love the Lord, then we have to work and we have to back it up. And we can deny that very quickly. So he is being taught these lessons. He's put in a working. He's working in a guy's house, and the Lord's just blessing him and going on. Very straightforward here. I didn't read the last half of verse 6, even though, did you notice that? I stopped short. This is what it says. Now remember, Joseph he was about 17 years old, the Bible says, when he got thrown out into slavery, and he's gone up in Pharaoh's in Potiphar's house here. And so he's probably in his late teens at this point. You know, some time has elapsed. We don't know how much. So he might be 19 years old, something like that. And the Bible says this about him. Now, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. You see that in verse 6? He was a good-looking dude. That's the Josh Standard version. He was a good-looking guy in form. So, I mean, he was well-built. And in appearance, he was pleasing to look at. So, I mean, he was a buff guy. You know, this is a guy, you know, he's young and he's attractive and he's blessed. He's got the respect of the people around him. He's, as a late teenager, we can think early 20s at oldest, he's already risen up to the point where he's in charge of everything in Potiphar's house, to the point where Potiphar doesn't even know what he owns other than the piece of bread he's about to take a bite of. That's what it says. Joseph's in charge of everything except for the bread in Potiphar's hand. That's what it says. And so that's how much he's trusted by Potiphar in this passage. Why would it say that he's a good-looking dude? Why would it say that? Well, it's the next passage, and it comes out pretty straightforward. I'm an expert, not in many things, and I'm definitely not an expert in what makes a good-looking dude. But you can think like a Ryan Gosling. Is he a good-looking dude? I think he's a good-looking dude. Anyway, so he's a good-looking dude, and he is somebody that might be able to look at it. Now we look at this, and we see Joseph and his temptation, which is just a kind of a bizarre turn of events. Read with me, and I'm going to read it in a couple of chunks here. Let's read verse 7 through 12 first, and looking at Joseph's... Did I put the weird apostrophe again? Oh my goodness. Joseph's... I'm struggling. I'm on the struggle bus tonight, guys. Oh, it does make me feel better. Thank you. Joseph's temptation. So let's read 7 through 12. And there's a request here and refusal, the two parts of it. And it came to pass, verse 7, after these things, that his master's wife, you can see this is going to go badly. His master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. It's a very blunt pickup line. Lie with me. Verse 8, but he refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you're his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God. So it was, as she spoke to Joseph the day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. So Joseph had gone into the pit based on the hatred of his brothers. And the proverb says that to be with the seductress is to go into a narrow well. That's what Proverbs says. And certainly he was being had this temptation before him to commit adultery and to commit sexual sin. And it's a greater danger in that she invites him directly into bed, and she's treating Joseph like a thing, not like a person, just trying to completely divorce the act of sex from any kind of relationship or anything, just completely objectifying him. And it's demeaning. This is honestly demeaning to Joseph. And it's she's this powerful woman and obviously has a prominent place in there and is coming on to Joseph, and it says day by day. His testimony there is that he won't do this great wickedness. He won't do this, and he's refusing. And I've got a couple of things I'd like to say here, and this has been very instructive for me as a young man. Number one is that objectifying and divorcing sex from any relationship, the marital relationship, is sin always. So we can say things across the board. Pornography is sinful. Expressions of sexuality outside of the committed covenant of marriage is sinful. It's wonderful and blessed and inside that commitment, but outside of that it is sinful. And it's wonderful to see this man, Joseph, this young guy that had it all going for him, just taking a stand with his purity and his integrity, being willing to sacrifice. He was unwilling to please what might have been his own flesh or please this woman's flesh. He says very specifically, you are another man's wife, period. And that other man happens to be my boss. No, and I'm not going to sin because it would be a great wickedness against God. So the sin that he would have committed had he went and lain with her, it would have been a sin against his own body, right? It's a sin, the flesh. It would have been a sin against this woman. It would have been a sin against Potiphar. It would have been a sin against Jacob back in the promised land and what he was supposed to do. But Joseph is very specific in verse 9 when he says, "How can I do this sin against God?" And so even if, and this is another thing that's always been instructive to me, even if Joseph had gotten away with it, okay? Even if he had been with Potiphar's wife and had committed this sin and gotten away with it and not faced any earthly consequences from it, the wickedness was against God. It would have been there, and he would have saw, "Oh, be careful, little eyes, what you see, for the Father up above is looking down with love. Oh, be careful, little eyes, what you see." And so there is this intensity to this event where this man sees an opportunity and denies it and stands for integrity, even though he probably could have, by a human perspective, gotten away with something here. And also something that's always struck me about this is that the decision to say no to Potiphar's wife had to have been made in advance of the first proposition. If he didn't have integrity and had not made decisions before getting into that situation of temptation, I don't know if a man can stand under that. You can't wait until you get into a temptation to decide to grow some moral integrity and make a right choice. You have to, time after time, fill yourself with truth, to hide God's word in your heart that you might not sin against him, to continually be in the word so you can, when you are put in that situation, you can have courage and integrity. And he goes out of his way there. And there's something humorous to me. I don't know why it is. It probably shouldn't be humorous to me. But it's something humorous to me that he gets in trouble again with a jacket here. That she grabs his jacket because it was the jacket with the brothers. And they did the whole thing with the jacket, the color of coat of many colors. And then now she's propositioning him. He says no, and she grabs his jacket. And like the old preacher says, you know, He loses a jacket, but he gained his character. He kept his character. And so she has this thing, and it's about to play a key role in what happens next. So this sin comes forward, and all of these lessons are built in. And one thing I'll say here before we move on is that men are visual creatures, and they are by nature visual, and they'll notice. That's why billboards are effective that have scantily clad women or a commercial on TV, and why we have to constantly be guarding our eyes. We're visual things, and I do thank very much the ladies of the church who are modest, and that just helps brothers out in Christ. It's just a good thing in general. It's loving to neighbor to do that, even though men are accountable for sure. But it's also here clear that, you know, women are visual too in some way, and we have to guard. We have to guard against both stereotypes. Men can be lustful. Women can be lustful. We just need to make sure we're guarding our hearts for sure. Even if, you know, no matter what you have in before you. So let's look at the next section here, and we'll see what comes out. Let's read in verse 13 to verse 20. So let me back up in verse 12. It says that she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. So it was when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, "See," you can imagine her holding up this jacket, "see, he has brought in to us a Hebrew to mock us, and he came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice," meaning she's accusing him of rape here. That's what's happening. "And it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside. He came on to me. He was going to force himself on me. I grabbed his coat and I screamed and he ran off. Here's the proof. I've got his coat." Completely lying and turning the table on him. This revenge. You can imagine it's because she felt insulted at being turned down by this young Hebrew slave. You know, how dare she would be rejected by him. Well, continuing to read here in verse 16. "So she kept his garment with her until his master came home." So here's when one Potiphar comes home. "And she spoke to him with words like these, saying, 'The Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came to me, mocked me. So it happened as I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled outside.' And so it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, 'Your servant did to me after this manner,' that his anger was aroused." He was angry about it. Verse 20. "Then Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was put there in prison." Now, it's worth saying, and many commentaries pointed this out, that Potiphar at this point had all the rights in the world to execute Joseph, to simply put him to death. There, in this society, this honor society, there wouldn't have been a question about it. But there's something in Joseph's proven character that gets him just imprisonment instead of execution. So you can imagine this is a pretty difficult period in Joseph's life. He is successful, but what do I mean by that? Successful does not mean necessarily everybody does you right and everything goes great with you and you never have hardships and there's never any unreasonable situations or accusations against you. This is certainly one of those situations where Joseph was in the right. And this woman is simply lying. There's nothing else to say other than that. She is trying to demean Joseph. So let me quickly give you the last one. We'll look at this together. Joseph's and his injustice. I'll read the last three verses and we'll be done with just a couple of comments. 21 through 23 says this, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison." Listen how similar this language is. "And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison, whatever they did, it was his doing. And the keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. So he's going, if you look at where we're at, he started this chapter as a slave, and he ended the chapter as a prisoner. So he didn't make a lot of transition here, but the Lord is blessing him. And that's the weird thing to say. He can be blessed, and we can be blessed, and sometimes not show the outward trappings of it. It is like the Lord's put him in this intense school. It's like the Lord is training him. The Lord is setting him aside for service in a special way, teaching him some lessons that are about to come full circle. And we'll see, this isn't the end of Joseph's kind of spiral. He's going to spend a few years in prison, and not at his own doing, because someone doesn't do what he promised to him. So he gets taken again for a ride on another trip next week. And we'll look at those together next week. Brother Garrett's going to lead the study next Sunday night, Lord willing, and we'll go from there. Any thoughts or questions in our text tonight? Well, time is up, but I'll certainly field any questions if there's anything. All right, well, let me dismiss us in a word of prayer, and we'll head to choir practice.